Hello. I'd like to talk about 325. What happened in that important, fateful, pivotal year? The Emperor of the Roman Empire, Constantine, called for a council, a convention of Christian leaders, and they convened in Nicaea, which is in modern Turkey. The 1,700th anniversary of this council was actually just a few weeks ago. And I was privileged to be on the program with a number of biblical scholars, people who do this full-time, unlike me, and church historians. And we commemorated that 1,700th anniversary. My talk I called The Aftermath of Nicaea, Seven Crucial Transitions Following 325. And I wasn't just focused on the 300s. I was talking about what happened in the wake of the council in the following centuries. But before I get any further, let's just have a very quick review of church history. The first century, the apostles are alive. They write the documents and their associates, the documents that will become the New Testament. There are many living eyewitnesses of Jesus. Of course, as the second century progresses, these living eyewitnesses die off, and eventually, they're only people who maybe saw the apostles when they were little children. And in the second century, the church is fairly healthy. We have a good understanding of this because so many writings have been left behind. For example, right now, I'm reading hundreds of pages written by one of the North African leaders, Clement of Alexandria. Well, there were kind of two things happening. Very slowly, the apostolic faith was morphing, and things were cooling off in some places. And at the same time, Christianity was growing. There was still a living faith. So there are these two currents, these two tendencies, one to cool off, one to remain hot, in fact, to burn even brighter. When we get into the third century, that is the 200s, persecution continues, and official Roman persecution had begun around the year 100 AD, but it was intermittent. The church continues to grow and to develop some fairly interesting doctrines. There are breakaway groups, schismatics, there are heretical groups, and the way they're dealt with is very informative for our own day. But it's still not easy to be a Christian, especially not easy to be a Christian leader. In the major persecutions in the late 3rd and early 4th century, Bibles were burned. Buildings where Christians assembled were destroyed. And bishops or church leaders were the ones who were executed. It wasn't the run-of-the-mill Christian, not to say none of them were martyred, but those who were targeted were those who were the public figures. And so this is the first three centuries of Christianity. And in fact, by the 4th century, the early 4th century, there's something like maybe 10% of the empire are favorable to Christianity or have become Christians. And that percentage will increase drastically, as I'll remind us another time. Well, the Council of Nicaea takes place early in the 4th century. No event changed the nature of the Christian faith more than this council. Not the rise of the clergy, not the monastic movement, not even the Reformation. No, I believe we can date so many future developments and important trends to this council itself. And when I say the aftermath of the council, again, I'm referring to numerous changes that were enacted or enabled by Nicaea and subsequent ecumenical councils, as they were called. Not necessarily immediate changes. Some of my perspectives may seem unnecessarily strong and perhaps even unfair, although I'm really trying to be even-handed. Nor do I want to leave the impression that I see little value in councils. I mean, think of the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15. That accomplished much good. Now, I don't think there's no value in councils, and I certainly don't reject the creed that emerged from the Council of Nicaea, and that was expanded at the next so-called ecumenical council in Constantinople. In fact, to be honest, I wish I had been there. I think it must have been incredibly exciting. Imagine the energy, hundreds of Christians coming together in safety. The persecution of the government had ended. In the Eastern Empire, it had completely ended by 324. In most of the empire, West and East, toleration came in around 311. Well, it became an actual edict allowing the Christian faith, what we call the Edict of Milan, shortly after that. But just imagine the energy coming together in a climate where the government is no longer against Christians. Christians are becoming more and more popular. Well, earlier this year, I was about 85 miles, almost 140 kilometers east of our home in England, because I wanted to, well, actually, I was visiting someone that I had met at a science conference last year, and he lived there. So my wife and I went out to York. Now, this is not New York. This is Old York, the original York. And while I was there, I noticed a statue of Constantine. And I was thinking, okay, Constantine. And of course, I'm reading the inscription and going online. And I was reminded that he was proclaimed emperor by the army in York. This is exactly where he was when he became emperor. Now, he wasn't emperor of the sole, he wasn't sole emperor of the empire, because the empire was divided into parts. But gradually, he prevailed. And in the next 10 years or so, he was the emperor of all the Roman Empire. So Constantine, York, in Britain, so far north, so far from home. Let me say one other thing before we get into the details of the aftermath. And that is that I'm not trying to judge Constantine's motives. He may have meant very well, and probably the prominent Christian leaders who came from all over the empire also meant well. I don't think they deliberately got together and said, hey, let's form a close alliance with the state. Let's take on the armor and the weapons of the world, and let's become big and let's get involved in politics. I don't think that was the intention. I'm willing to believe that motives were very, very pure for the most part. But still, there's some concerning things. Okay, enough qualification. Today, I'd like to just talk about one of my concerns. I have seven observations about Nicaea and its aftermath. And so, number one, shibboleths and labeling. Well, we know what it is to be labeled. If you're not familiar with shibboleth, let me read from Judges chapter 12. Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, you are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh. And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, let me go over, the men of Gilead said to him, are you an Ephraimite? And when he said, no, they said to him, then say shibboleth. And he said, sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. And they seized him and slaughtered him at the fords of the Jordan. At that time, 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell. That's Judges 12, 4 to 6. So to tell whether someone was from the right tribe, they used a pronunciation test. Shibboleth is simply a word meaning an ear of corn or a flowing stream. But these poor fellows couldn't pronounce the Hebrew letter shin. They would use the letter sin instead. And so they were saying sibboleth, which actually means nothing at all in Hebrew. And so a shibboleth is like a touchstone. It's something by which you determine whether someone is kosher, is on the right side. So shibboleths and labeling. Nicaea seems to have originated the notion that fellowship and maybe even salvation depends on technical theology. And by that, I mean this. A test of orthodoxy, of correct faith, was hinging on a technical word that's not even found in in the New Testament, the word homoousios. Homoousios means being of the same substance. The council was convened because there was a group who were called Arians, following a leader whose name was Arius, who said that Jesus at some point became God. Either the Godhead came upon him, or he was a created being in some way, but not fully God, not as Orthodox Christians believe, and as probably you and I would say. And so actually they called the Arians Ariomaniacs. That's actually the word from way back then. But if you didn't agree with the word homoousios, then you were suspect. So that was the shibboleth. And Athanasius, one of the main leaders, labeled as Arians anyone who didn't affirm the Nicene Creed exactly as worded. Well, you know, it's the Bible. Sometimes we say no creed but the Bible. Now, I personally have no problem with the Nicene Creed. In fact, if you go to my website, that's my statement of faith. You know, what do you believe? Well, here, how about that? It's pretty good. I'll read it for us at the beginning of my next talk. But to judge brothers and sisters based on their understanding of the Trinity seems pretty harsh. Now, you might say, didn't 2 John say that if you deny that Jesus came in the flesh, you're the Antichrist? Yes, and what he's saying is not, if you deny Jesus had a physical body, that would be wrong also, but we believe in the incarnation. God became flesh. For some Christians, this didn't seem, and non-Christians, this didn't seem very reasonable. But I don't think the Arians weren't saying that Jesus isn't God in nature. It was really a dispute on whether he was always God in nature, whether that came or maybe came and went. Now, if you're slightly confused, do you really believe that you have to be able to explain the Trinity to be a true Christian? Because if church membership depends on opposing the Arian position and being a proper Nicene Christian, I'm not sure how many members of our churches would still remain. This is not easy stuff. But when it comes to shibboleths, labeling others we disagree with, I don't think this is an ancient issue. I think it's very modern. For example, it may be the terminology we use. Maybe you call your church leader, maybe you call him an evangelist, you know, who's really a church planter, if I understand the New Testament, but you may call that, or maybe use the word pastor. Not my favorite word, because it's a Latin word. There's already an English word. It's called shepherd. Why use the Latin equivalent? But some people feel very strongly about that, or they use a term like quiet time. You know, what's the doctrine of the quiet time in the New Testament? Have you had your quiet time today? And if people don't use that lingo, or their practice doesn't line up with our practice, we may feel uncomfortable. So this applies to terminology, to practices. Christians may judge one another or other congregations or denominations based on music, whether they use instruments or sing a cappella, or what kind of songs they sing, or practices like the choice of Bible translation. Do they use the NIV or not? Terminology, practices, opinions on non-biblical matters, like science stuff. Do you believe in a Big Bang or not? Or politics. And so when it comes to labeling and shibboleths and the division, the damage that this does, and this is very intense in Nicaea, I think we're simply continuing a trend that had already been set in motion, certainly in the second century. But here we are in the early fourth century, and those who didn't go along with it, who were labeled, they were out. They were completely out. Well, that's just one of the consequences, shibboleths and labeling. Six more will follow, beginning with artificial unity. But that will be in the next talk. Thanks for listening.